So I know roughly what I want to say today, but not exactly what the words are, so I guess we'll see how it goes. A warm welcome to you. So really in two parts. First, I think about where is God in our suffering? First with the psalmist, a little bit about me, and then about Jesus, and then kind of shorter second bit, thinking about kind of where tears help or ways in which they help. So, bit of a spoiler really. So the first bit, where's God in our suffering? I'm going to suggest that God's present in our suffering and shares in our suffering, our pain and our tears, rather often than miraculously changing them. Although, obviously there are one or two times when God does, you know, miraculously intervene. And also suggest that really Jesus demonstrates that God's way of presence, God's way of perseverance, right up to and through death itself. And like I say, well, you know, that's where I think we get to in this first bit. So first, just going back through that psalm and thinking of some of the images that the psalmist uses, and just kind of take it a line at a time. Lord, don't rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath. So the psalmist has got this sense that he's under God's discipline. It's a psalm of David. Maybe David wrote it. Maybe it's just written about David. A few weeks ago, we looked at the psalm where, you know, David's kind of reflecting on his adultery with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah, and the sort of prophetic judgment over that is that as a result there's going to be conflict in his family, you know, from then on. And, you know, perhaps that's what, you know, David has in mind here. You know, he's in a situation, as we'll see, where he feels opposed to the, you know, to the point of tears, almost despair, and, you know, perhaps that's what he's thinking has led to it. Have mercy on me, Lord, for I'm faint, you know, so there's, and heal me, for my bones are in agony. It's a little bit hard to tell whether he's saying, you know, this is sort of my emotional state, you know, this kind of, you know, the bones here doesn't literally mean bones. It's kind of, you know, your sort of, we talk about your marrow, it's kind of the, you know, who you are deep down. But there's a sense of pain and faintness, and maybe even there's an element of, you know, actual physical suffering or illness in there as well. My soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord, how long? So he asks, as many psalms do, as many other bits in the Bible do, there's a sense of frustration, of waiting for God, of God not, you know, in some ways delivering what he's hoping for, what he's waiting for. And he sits in pain, in this sense of hurt and anguish. Turn, Lord, you know, so maybe reflecting on that sense of God's delay, he asks God, turn towards me. He feels like God is facing away. Turn toward me, deliver me. You know, I mean, I've got this situation I need to be delivered from. I need to be saved out of this situation. It's something that's beyond the psalmist, more than he can cope with. And he argues, in a sense, with God. Among the dead, no one proclaims your name, and who praises you from the grave? He's kind of saying, God, please do something now before I die, because then I'll be able to praise you. And incidentally, that kind of reflects in part some of the ways that the kind of Jews' understanding of death and what happens after death kind of varies and changes over time. You know, here there's no real sense from the psalmist of, you know, of life after or beyond death, even though, you know, that's something that, you know, we've come to expect and to hope for. At the heart of the psalm is this, you know, sort of very emotional expression that he's worn out from groaning all night long. He floods his bed with weeping. drenches his couch with tears. Well, at least he has a couch. I guess that's a plus, isn't it? And, you know, deep emotion and tears as the expression of that. His eyes are weak with sorrow. And then this the opposition that he faces starts to become more explicit in the psalm. So my eyes fail because of my foes. There's some sort of enemy. And given that it's David, it probably is, you know, some of that element of civil war that it, you know, erupts around kind of the succession and his children in conflict. And then the psalm at the end takes a little bit of an upswing in hope, at least. Away from me, all you who do evil, for the Lord has heard my weeping, has heard my cry for mercy, and accept my prayer. And there's also, you know, so he's holding on to this hope, this confidence, if you like, that God has heard, you know, that heartfelt cry that starts just as tears, and then as it becomes perhaps a little more articulate, that cry for mercy and then actually a prayer, something that he can you know, entreat God with, and he trusts that God's accepted it. And the consequence will be that his enemies will be overwhelmed with shame and anguish and turn back and suddenly be put to shame. Although that's still a future hope for him in the psalm. So, what really was or is the psalmist's problem? And we, to some extent, we don't entirely know. You know, there's that image of, you know, God's discipline and anger. There's also, you know, that element of, you know, is the physical pain and suffering in it? But perhaps overall a clearer sense that it's this sense of opposition, kind of worldly opposition, his foes and enemies against him, who have left him in this apparently impossible situation. And he pleads with God to do something about it. So that's, you know, very briefly the psalmist's experience of tears in this psalm. I'll perhaps say a little bit of my own experience. So I'm definitely, you know, the opposite end of the spectrum of expressiveness from Gwyn. So if I think about tears, you know, where I go straight off would be to when my dad died. These are my parents. And it was only just after we'd got married, so it's quite a while ago, literally 5 weeks after we got married. We were living in London, and my mum phoned and started to run through her, you know, in a very sort of, she's a bit like me, so in a very detached sort of way, the story of what's happened. And you know, it's obvious that where we're getting to is that my dad's died, but she doesn't kind of say that until partway through. And, you know, I kind of recall, you know, a sense of kind of collapsing or sitting by the phone. Obviously, we had wired phones in those days, not mobile phones, and being comforted by Ness. And I don't know if it really was the first time, but, you know, there's a sense in that situation that, you know, for me at least, something cracks, and you know, that kind of well of grief and tears comes to the surface. And I don't know if you experience this the same, but it feels like there's this one well of tears, and all kinds of different situations tap into it. But it's not like this kind of different tears. So, you know, even, you know, things as, you know, things like, I have a very soft spot for the children's story, The Velveteen Rabbit. Always brings tears to my eyes. See, I'm choking up now. But, you know, it really taps into that same grief. So, and some mystics would say, you know, not only is it this one well of tears that we encounter within ourselves, but that in some sense it connects all of us and it connects God. That all of our tears, in some sense, are God's tears. And the spiritual journey is both an outward thing and an inward thing, and we encounter God both outside, but also as we explore deep within our own hearts too. So, talk a little bit about Jesus' experience, obviously also equals God's experience, or God's experience in human form, in the flesh, in incarnation. And there's two or three times where, we know that Jesus himself cries. So, shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. It's not long before the crucifixion and all that stuff of Holy Week. Lazarus dies. You may recall Jesus kind of hangs around for a bit, and then he goes to the house of Mary and Martha, and Lazarus is in the tomb, and he weeps. People see him cry as he presumably contemplates Lazarus and his death, but also what he anticipates is going to be coming up, and indeed the state of the world. And on this one occasion, as in just a couple of others, Jesus is not only moved, but he goes to the tomb, and as you'll know, he actually raises Lazarus. He anticipates the resurrection, although in this case, this is just a foretaste of it. Lazarus still dies and awaits that final resurrection. So we see death moving Jesus to tears, and in that case to action. Just a little later on, although it's in one of the other Gospels, as Jesus is on Palm Sunday going into Jerusalem, he cries again. He sees the city, which stands really for the whole Jewish people, the whole kind of salvation project that God's been working out, and he cries over it. And there he anticipates quite directly the destruction of Jerusalem, which happened about 40 years later, after the Jews rebel yet again and have a fairly major war with the Romans, which not surprisingly the Romans win. But he cries again for his people, for God's people. Or even a little later still, literally just before the cross, Jesus, think of him on the Mount of Olives as he prays with Peter, James and John in anguish. And sweat falling like blood, presumably tears as well, although it doesn't say explicitly. And then, we then get the events of Good Friday unfolding as Jesus is tried and crucified. So, people often ask, why does God allow suffering? It hurts, it's not fair, it's unjust. There are so many unjust things in the world. Why doesn't God do something about it? And indeed, if you have certain forms of theology, then you would have to say, why does God do that? And that's kind of, it's almost where the psalmist is coming from. He sees this oppression by his enemies as an action of God's judgment on him. But I guess at the heart of it really is this question, does God actually care? Does God care about us? And, I guess a better way or a more helpful way of asking the question, or at least the question of whether God cares, is where is God in our suffering? This stuff happens. Where's God? Does he care? And hopefully those examples and some of your own experience will witness to the fact that God does care, and he demonstrates that care by being present in it, both in our individual situations as we encounter those gentle movements of the Spirit or encouragement of those around us, and very, very occasionally something remarkable. But for the most part, God with us now, and that pattern of Jesus, God in Jesus, demonstrating that for reasons which we don't fully understand, but probably have something to do with free will and creating a world that's kind of rich, and that God chooses to allow a whole bunch of stuff to unfold and to be present in it. You know, and just as Jesus is present in the world, and God doesn't, you know, kind of do the things that people expected would happen, overthrow the Roman Empire, for example, but that Jesus demonstrates a pattern of persevering through everything that happens, even right into death, but that somehow there's this bigger picture. There's something going on that's beyond our immediate sight, which means that starting with Jesus, it doesn't end with death, but there's actually then that moment of resurrection and of new life. So how can tears help? Here are just four thoughts. Tears can help us to be honest with ourselves about what we're feeling and experiencing, you know, especially if you're that, you know, like me, you're kind of not terribly in touch with your emotions most of the time. Then when you get to that point where tears start to flow, it's kind of an unavoidable sign that something's going on. And, you know, if we can kind of bear with that discomfort, I suppose, to begin with, sometimes embarrassment, to actually discern, okay, really, what's this saying? Tears also invite and express compassion. This is obviously not a canonical reference, but if you've seen the film Inside Out, then you know you'll be aware that so these are the sort of driving emotions of a preteen called Riley, and Joy tries to control the whole of her life and make sure nothing sad ever happens. Sadness is over on the end, and through the film it transpires that sadness is actually kind of a really important part of life, and in her case, being open to the to be honest and accept the care of her parents. Tears help us enter into the pain of the world and perhaps respond more appropriately. So as Paul writes in Romans, the whole of creation, it's not just us who suffer, but the whole of creation is groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. And what's creation waiting for? It's waiting for the children of God to be revealed, for God to reveal, bizarrely, in us and people like us, his new order, his new kingdom, the work of restoration and new and resurrection that he's in the process of doing. And lastly, you know, I guess as that psalm also takes that upswing at the end, as many of them do, as the psalmist turns to hope and to trust that God will respond, then as Jesus says in the Beatitudes, you know, those who mourn will be comforted. Our tears also do hold that hope, that anticipation, that trust of future comfort. And I suppose one of the more obvious places where you see that is in John's revelation of the new heaven and the new earth. And he says, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. And what will that mean, God with us, in a way that is much more immediate and face-to-face than we experience it now? That he'll wipe every tear from their eyes, and there'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order has passed away. So that's our hope, our trust as Christians, that's, you know, all of this broken stuff that we see in the world around us now is part of an even bigger picture. You know, God doesn't control things in the way that we might like him to, you know, on a second-to-second and moment-to-moment basis. But nonetheless, you know, as it says elsewhere in the Bible, underneath are the everlasting arms. There's something about God's holding all things in the end.